Okay, we're gonna come to order. Senators, the House is in debate on the fuel tax, and it's going to go for a while. What's your preference? We have questions of John. Do you want to hear some of the things? But that doesn't mean that the House members may not want you back, John. But I'd say since you're here, let's go ahead and ask our questions. And before we go on to the retirement and those, I think we're going to have the full committee here. What anybody have any thoughts on that? Well, I'm just asking you what you want to do. We could have any kind of any motions in order, obviously. Senator Dockstader, turn your mic on, please.
We kind of cut our director off. We ran out of time just to make sure there's anything else we need to do, but we'd probably need the full body here for the rest of them.
Yeah, that's my preference, John. What we'll do is go ahead, and you had something you were saying. Let's continue that testimony, and then we will ask some questions and some of the things we have, and then we'll release you. And for anybody else that's out there, what we're going to do is that'll be all we'll do till the House can join us. So if anybody else is here waiting, it'll probably be around 4 or 4:30, something like that, before we can get to anybody else. So, John, welcome back. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a couple of questions asked of us this morning that we were not prepared for, and in the intervening time, we were able to get a better answer for you. There was a question asked relative by Chairman Harshman, relative to the counties that have not signed on to WildLink and why. And what we brought is a handout that will explain that. The short answer is those five counties and the WildLink system are working together to get them on. And what we've done is put together a little spreadsheet that shows which counties. Those are Bighorn, Lincoln, Sublette, Uinta, and Weston, and also their reasons for not being signed on yet and the progress that's being made toward that. At the bottom of that handout is a statement about the federal government agencies that are using the WildLink system, and the question was asked. I'm sorry, it looks like that. It says WildLink questions January 16th at the top. At the bottom of that graph, there's a statement that goes to the question that was asked this morning, I believe, by Representative Moniz, with regard to I think the FBI was cited. Are the federal agencies paying to be subscribers to the WildLink system? And there's a statement there that addresses that.
Time out, John. Let's find what we're looking for.
All right. Okay. Did you get a handout like that? There is a separate page handout. My apology, I should have held up until you had it. Thank you. Now, this one's out as well. Okay, this one, right? You got it now. Thank you.
Okay, John, now we got it.
Okay. Looking down the left-hand column of that
graph there.
I thought
this was a new move by YDOT to see if we were paying attention, so continue.
Mr. Chairman, we're not near that smart. Shows the five counties and an explanation on the right-hand column. The short answer to the question of why they're not, or if there's progress being made toward getting them on the system, the answer to that question is yes, there is progress being made. It's a work in progress. Our hope is to see all five of them on if that's what they desire. The bottom paragraph on that page addresses the question that was asked this morning about whether or not federal government agencies are paying a fee to be part of the WildLink system. And in short, the federal agencies were able to provide for us some frequencies that we could not otherwise access. In fact, the value of those frequencies was considerable. And so it was a more of a barter sort of relationship, but it was well worth it for us to enter into that with them. Mr. Chairman, I'm
before
sorry.
You leave that, so you the feds let you use some of their frequencies now, but they could also, what they give you, they take away. Now, is the whole WildLink system based on some of those frequencies or not? I mean, what part of it would they be involved in?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have Ken Schultz answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, the entire system is not based on that. That's I don't have a map of just exactly where those are. It's kind of ironic. Most of the frequencies that we are using belong to the U.S. Coast Guard, and they have frequencies across the country. Obviously, the Coast Guard doesn't have a presence in Wyoming, and they're sharing in their frequencies to benefit their sister agencies in participating in WildLink. I don't really have a count. They don't have any desire to see this. The federal government, interoperable communications is a priority for them, as it is for Wyoming. And they see the importance of this, and they have not indicated that they have any desire to take those away. But just to note, they do have control of those, and if a need was to arise, they could come back and ask to get those back. And with no recourse.
Okay, just procedurally, we are licensed to use those. Is that the only kind of a contractual agreement or MOU you might have with the government on this? Is just the fact that they license it to you? Is there some kind of an MOU you should have, or have you thought about that?
Mr. Chairman, there is no MOU for that. There is just the licenses for those frequencies at this point in time.
And those licenses, are they time limited? Do they say anything about... is it between the federal government / the U.S. Coast Guard and the state of Wyoming, or are they just...
Mr. Chairman, it's a convoluted kind of thing where it goes from the Coast Guard through the FCC and through another agency, the NTIA. They allocate frequencies.
You don't have to go into all that. Just what you might do, and it's something we don't need right away, but okay. Just because of that concern, it's valid, I think, to maybe look in how you've got those, and maybe there's something we could do differently.
I will ask the folks that do that. There's a just Mr. Chairman, the PSCC folks who are now under Homeland Security, their administrative folks are the ones that work the frequency issue directly, and then we participate in that on the side, and they could probably address that, and I will ask them and get an answer for you.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be immediately, but if you would, please. Senator Perkins.
Chairman, just following up while we're talking about interoperability and use and non-use, how is that among, I understand your interoperability, and that's a big deal for, I mean, obviously in the aftermath of 9/11, the interoperability became a very hot button, and rightly so. But as we started down that road, we had, I think, Cheyenne and certainly Casper and some others, I think, where it went to the 800 megahertz, and then the WildLink came through, and I think you're at 123 or whatever that number was. It's been a few years since I played with this one. But how was from your perspective, how is interoperability around the state? I mean, I know we had those issues with Casper. Are they now, is there adapters that allow interoperability with the 800 megahertz system with the state system? Or do they still have to carry around a second set of radios?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, they do not have to carry a second set of radios. There is interoperability with Casper, with Cheyenne, and with two sites in the Gillette area where Campbell County built some 800 sites and had made a significant investment in that. We have those linked together so that they can use the same radios if they choose to. They do not have to choose. They can choose to use two radios, or they can choose to use one, depending on what their preference and their operations dictate.
And Mr. Chairman, I just follow up on that same thing. And then, I mean, obviously, once you have these towers, you have a certain umbrella, and typically, at least in my county in Casper, those towers are on top of Casper Mountain, and it seems like every 3 or 4 years we have a significant fire event on Casper Mountain, which has a tendency to put those at risk. And I'm wondering where we are, and that may be an issue that we have in a number of places, because we stick antennas for line of sight in high places, and high places a lot of times have trees. Do we have, and I was looking at the map of the tower sites we had before, and it looks like we're getting some redundancy there to so that if we have an event that takes out a tower, that we'd still have some operability. But from your perspective, where are we on that now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we're improving. There are some gaps that we are working on currently with regard to the microwave backbone that WIDOT is supplying, where there, in certain cases, there are some places where, quite frankly, if something was to go down, we'd see a significant outage. We have been working on that. We had some concerns with the Casper Mountain fires this summer, the fires in the Newcastle area and all. I mean, it is a concern for us, along with all of the other folks that have those mountaintop sites, and we're working to try to figure out a way to do as much as we can to provide some redundancy or some coverage in that, and that effort is underway.
And I'm assuming then that you, as a part of that, you probably also have, let me just ask it this way. Do you have, I mean, without, you don't want to be, and you certainly don't want to have equipment that ages around and don't get used, but do you have spares or things like that, so that if you lose some of the repeaters and other things that are out there, that those can be replaced in a, obviously not going to be immediately, but in a fairly rapid short replacement period?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that question is yes. We do carry spares for the mountaintop equipment and in strategic locations. I mean, we obviously don't have a spare at every location. That would be crazy, but we do have redundant spares so that we can respond to this in a timely fashion and get those things back up as quickly as possible. We also have equipment for accessing those mountaintops should something happen in the wintertime. So we have snowcats and other equipment to do so. So we're well prepared to deal with that at this time.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
A couple of issues, and these are kind of constituent issues, more or less, on it. And I think that Chairman Bebout went over one of them with you at the close here. But if you had the time to look at this was a question by a constituent that wanted to know the total FTEs and maybe by classification of jobs when the department was maybe at the height of the interstate building of the highways and versus the total today. And I think his assumption was that when we were building the interstate, we were probably building more roads than we ever have or will ever do. I don't know if that's a correct assumption or not, but just trying to get an idea about how the department handle that with the workload during that building period versus the miles of road that we construct today and the number of employees.
Mr. Chairman, we'll have to get information and get it back to you to answer that question. And if I understand the question, you're wanting a comparison between FTEs today and during the building boom of the interstate highways, which would essentially be I-80. That would take us all the way back to the 60s. We'll have to do some digging, but I'm sure we can find some archive information.
And I think it was his presumption that we had less engineers and we're building more highways. We had less employees and we're building more highways than we are today. And I don't know if that's a correct assumption or not.
I can't answer that at this time, but we'll find information for you.
The other thing that was a concern was driving from Torrington to Cheyenne this year, we had a lot of construction. We really loved those passing lanes. That has helped out a bunch. But during the construction, there was a highway construction sign, and you weren't out of that construction zone for about 35 miles. Yet the construction only took place in maybe two places. That was maybe a course of, you know, a couple of 3 miles, and then 15 miles down the road, it was a couple of 3 miles. And I think his concern was that sign, basically had a blanket stretch of 35 miles if they got a speeding ticket, whether or not that would be considered in a construction zone because it was posted, yet you'd go 10 or 15 miles without any evidence of any construction zone whatsoever. So I'm just kind of curious how that was enforced this year and what your policy is in enforcement in a construction zone or work zone.
Mr. Chairman, I regret that Colonel Butler isn't here to speak specifically to construction zone enforcement for reduced superintendent speed zones, reduced speed limits during those construction times. I will say in the broader sense that a periodic question that comes up for us and has been a priority to act upon has been traffic control that's erected adjacent or through a construction site. Length of that traffic control, duration of the traffic control, how far outside of the actual construction area that it stretches are all questions that we have fielded, and in recent years we have acted on to bring that down to a manageable level. The traffic control on a construction site is actually carried out by the contractor that does the construction work for us, but the whole construction project is overseen by WIDOT, so it's our responsibility to make that a reasonable length of stretch along the highway. I'm not familiar with the one that you're referring to, and in those cases, it's of great benefit to us to learn about the concerns while that is in place so that we can send our people out there to check and figure out what's going on. But beyond that, I'm sorry, I don't have any specifics on that particular site.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that, I guess it came from about the four-mile draw, which is about 3 miles north of Meriden, all the way out to Pole Creek. That was the length of the construction zone. And that was the area which you were doing the passing lanes. But the passing lane construction themselves were where you had traffic control by the contractor, you know, might have been 2 miles, so, or 3 miles.
You know. Mr. Chairman, this is a little bit speculative on my part, but if you have an elongated stretch there within which you're putting a sequence of passing lanes, for instance, that's the picture that I'm getting here, I'm only familiar enough with traffic engineer stuff to be dangerous, but I would speculate this far. And that is, if there's a sequence of passing lanes going in, it may actually be a detriment to run the speed limit back up to 65 in the stretches where that actual construction is not taking place if they're just going to encounter within a few miles stretch another passing lane construction area. If there were, for instance, if there were two or three or several in there, then there might be a good reason for that to be the speed limit. I would be more concerned with if there was no construction activity going on whatsoever and you still had a reduced speed limit in that stretch. That would be one that I would want an answer for in a real speedy manner. But I could see some engineering reasoning for having, if you have several pieces of construction in a stretch, having a consistent speed limit so that you don't have an accordion effect build up in the traffic.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the speed limit was 65 until you got close to the actual construction zone.
Okay.
But I think their concern was as well, are you going to get that enhanced penalty for going over 65 when it's the normal highway speed?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. I don't think so. If it's a 65 statutory speed limit in between those construction zones, then the superintendent's speed zone provisions would not apply, I don't believe.
Even though it's posted as a construction zone for 35 miles?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, that's something that, you know, I don't think anybody wanted to find that out the wrong way, so they asked me to ask you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
Yeah.
I thought it was a slowdown all the way through there, even in the places where no building was taking place. Mr. Chairman, I think the most recent handout that you were given is entitled Joint Appropriations Committee SALEX Subscriber Agencies. The SALEX system is the state agency law enforcement communication system. That's existed since the 1970s, as the handout says. And there's a list of a half a dozen subscribers to that. These are agencies, including two federal agencies, that do pay a fee. But what they're paying for is not membership on the system, but dispatching services that are rendered by the state. So this is an efficiency move that was undertaken way back. and has continued to be viable. Just for your information, it's part of the SALEC system, so we thought we'd give you that information. Mr. Chairman, I think the most important thing, there's a couple other things I would like to go over if time allowing, but perhaps the most important thing was relative to the question of what the future anticipated costs are of the WildLink system. And we gave you a bad answer this morning, and we want to back up and accurize that, so I'm going to ask Kevin to take it from here. A do-over, if it's allowed. We hope so, anyway.
Mr. Chairman, this morning you were provided a handout that looks something like this that represented future anticipated or projected costs for WildLink. If you look at the handout that we provided to address this question, it's titled Wyoming Department of Transportation WildLink Budget Question Response. It's a little spreadsheet. On this spreadsheet, column C is, in fact, the 2015-2016 biennium numbers that were in this spreadsheet this morning. So those numbers are the very same on the document that was provided to you earlier today and now the spreadsheet that I'll bring to your attention. Column C, this morning there was a comment that it was going to require $8 million a year to maintain WildLink. In reality, the handout for the biennium 2015-2016 anticipated cost is $6.7 million for the biennium. Now, in that, you'll note that in column D, and if you want me to, I can show you on page 20 of the budget that has been provided to you, the supplemental budget. In column D, record 1, on the very far left-hand side of the spreadsheet, you'll see 1 through 5. Column D, there's $1,256,045 for T1 lines. That's in the budget. So the next one would be $1.6 million on the same page. On the column 2 of the supplemental budget request, you'll see that there's professional service fees for $1.6 million. That's in column D. And then you'll also see software upgrade agreement, and you'll note that we discussed the supplemental budget request for 2014 for $1,530,000. So far, of the $6.7 million that we have anticipated cost for 2015-2016, $4.3 million is already in the budget. Now, if you'll refer to page 19 of the supplemental budget request, you'll note the language that I have referenced in column E, which is on our spreadsheet at $1,591,200. What it says is this maintenance agreement, we're talking about the software maintenance agreement that we have the supplemental budget for $1.5 million for 2014. This maintenance agreement will start in fiscal year 2014 and reflects only one half of what will be anticipated in the following 2015-2016 biennium. Reoccurring prices will rise by 4% per year. Now, that's what Motorola has advised us. So in 2015, expect that to double because we're paying for 2014 in the supplemental. When we get into 2015-2016, that'll actually double. Now, over in column G, you'll note that there's a variance in the budget request and how much we anticipated the budget, as we've represented the document, is $67,762. You can scratch that off because we'll hold Motorola to the expectation of the 4% increase for those services for the software. So that's $67,762. We will do our best to see that that agreement is held up. Now, in the budget request for in column G, you'll note that the T1 circuits, we currently have a $1.2 million budget, but we're not going to need as much for T1 circuits. The reason is that we buy T1 circuits currently so that we can communicate in areas where we don't have microwave capability. As we do stand up the towers and improve the system, those costs will go down. Originally, we were dealing with about if my memory serves me right, about $3 million a biennium for those T1 circuits, and now we're suggesting that it'll be $835,992. Now, that's about pretty much the bottom. We're going to have some T1 lines, but we will recommend that that be reduced up in the upcoming biennium. So if you look at the spreadsheet and you understand what was said this morning, we have everything budgeted with the exception of basically about $700,000. Now, in this, on record number 2, column D or column C, you'll see a request in there for $936,000. These are parts and pieces. We talked about that earlier. Mr. Ken Schultz said that we have reserved parts and places. Parts do go bad. And to date, we use the seed money that the Transportation Commission provided us in the original startup of Wildlink to pay for these parts. The Transportation Commission put in about $15 million. That money is no longer there. We've spent that money. Now, we will certainly vet with the Joint Appropriations Committee the question whether or not we general fund these pieces and parts or if the Department of Transportation will continue to pick up those costs. But that discussion will take place in the budget building process of the 2015-2016 budget. So knowing that, assume for a second that the $936,000 is not a general fund budget request, then we will actually be submitting a budget that is less than anticipated, not more, and certainly not $8 million a year. I'll certainly answer any questions that the committee has.
Say the last thing you just said again. You said that you thought that you'll be submitting a budget that's how much less than originally anticipated?
If you look at the $936,000,
right,
and we don't know the answer to that question, if it's going to be generally funded or not.
Okay, right.
So if you assume that we were short in the discussion in the spreadsheet by $741,000, you take off the $67,000, you're bouncing in there about $650,000. You strike the $936,000. That puts us long by a couple hundred thousand dollars. But the key question is that we have to ferret out and discuss what the pieces and parts will be for the future.
Okay.
But we have not had that discussion.
All right. Thanks. On the on Wildlink, in the going forward, it's been a while since I've talked about this. I haven't worked on Wildlink since I've been in the legislature, but I remember working on it as a county commissioner. But the in the funding and the maintenance of Wildlink, is there any charge back to any local agency with respect to their use of Wildlink, or was this always intended to be a statewide system that is owned and operated by and maintained by the state?
Senator Perkins, I don't know how to answer the second question, what the intent was, but I will tell you that to date there has not been any charges levied to local agencies or agencies outside of WIDOT who is providing the backbone system for participation in the system. And in fact, if you look at the bottom of that same spreadsheet that Kevin was talking you through there, you'll see the line that's entitled Local Government Issue.
Right.
There will come a time when consoles, as the hardware and the software obsolesces and has to be replaced in the future, there will come a time when that equipment, that local user equipment, is going to have to be replaced. During the build-out of this system, which was coincident with federal standards mandating a certain level of equipment, so all that came together kind of at that same time. That's why Wildlink really was stood up. During that time, a combination of your work in the legislature, as a legislature, and Homeland Security grants, which since 9/11 were plentiful, now not.
Right. My recollection was, I mean, certainly at the county level, we paid for almost all of our equipment that was for this with Homeland Security grants.
Yep, and I think that was largely true throughout the state. There was some skin in the game, in-kind sort of stuff for local tower sites, that kind of stuff, but largely that was paid for by the state and by federal grants. So the question will become, who's going to pay for it next time around.
Right. And I mean, and have you guys, I mean, and looking at this, as we look at column, and I think this is what we're trying to get to, is when we look at column C on the handout, and or maybe it's column F, but I mean, hold on, have you guys kind of figured this out? I mean, ultimately there's going to be a there's going to be a cycle of equipment replacement
mm-hmm.
for both for everything,
mm-hmm.
Even towers, although hopefully those, you know, those will be decades long, but ultimately you guys have kind of figured that out. Is when we look at F, is that what we would look at as the as kind of the biennial cost to maintain this going forward, or do we know that answer yet? Have you guys put pen to paper on that yet?
I believe that the column F is representative of what we're going to experience in 2015-2016. We have been asked by the governor to put together a long-range plan to address what that question would be in the future after 2015-2016, get a real good hard number for that so that we can share and try to develop what the future plan will be.
All right, so you'll end up with a maintenance plan, be like the other maintenance plan you have, whether it's equipment or airplanes or whatever, and you'll put that through. But right now we haven't looked any further down road, and you haven't peered in your crystal ball any further than 2015-2016 at this point, right?
We're in a process of getting a really hard, good plan for that.
All right. Well, we'll have a lot more fun discussions. Senator Dockstader. Look at the word. Don't you feel empowered, Senator Dockstader? We're here by ourselves, down to two of us.
Well,
substantially.
Yes, we are.
We're going to be talking to ourselves here pretty soon.
Wait a minute.
What do you mean pretty soon? Just really quick, out of those counties who haven't done it, it just kind of caught my attention as Senator Perkins was recalling how it was funded in each county. They would use federal grants. So we're down to five counties. Four of them are citing coverage issue for WildLink, and my home turf is saying that they're not paying for it. Did they not use a grant or something? They miss an opportunity there?
Mr. Chairman, it's a little bit of both. There was a certain amount of grant money through the PSCC available, and there was a certain window of time during which those grants could be applied for. And I know the money is used, and I also know that and there wasn't enough to go around. And I also am aware, although I can't cite specific local governments, in this case, I am aware that there are some who did not apply within that window of time.
And these grants would have been in the 2000. Started writing in 2002, 2003, and 2004. There was a lot of money that was coming out. In my recollection is there was a lot of money coming out that was available for Homeland Security efforts. I remember spending $1 million something on radios in Natrona County, probably in 2004.
There was a $12 plus million appropriation during Governor Friedenthal's administration. I don't remember the specific year, but we were the checkbook holder, but right. It was a PSCC authority, and that was, I think, later than that, more recent. Okay. And that was specific to filling gaps in local coverage,
mm-hmm.
As the backbone was built out. And that it was largely to that I was referencing.
Okay. Chairman, unless you want to appropriate some money for them.
Should we appropriate some money while no one's here? I don't think we have a majority to do that. But okay, is there anything else that you wanted to tell the two of us here this afternoon?
Yes, sir. There was a question posed this morning relative to administrative costs. I think it was Chairman Harshman that brought it up. For YDOT compared to other states. And I think Kevin got some information between then and now.
Yes, the question was, is how does Wyoming compare to the administrative costs when we're delivering a construction project? There's a comparison, and I'll just speak to the seven-state average. The seven-state average for administrative costs.
What seven states?
And I'm talking, excuse me, for the administrative costs, the ones that compare apple to apple,
for our indirect cost allocation plan would be Colorado, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Currently, Wyoming, we're at 8.23% on our administrative cost. Now, that is wide out across the board administrative costs for deliverable, and that includes the deliverable cost for a construction project or even a regular maintenance work. In that same comparison, Colorado is at 9%, Idaho is at 11.22%, and Montana is at 9.64%.
Go through this one more time, please.
Okay. Wyoming, ICAP, administration cost is 8.23%. Colorado is 9%. Idaho is 11.22%. And Montana is 9.64%. So you'll see that Wyoming's administrative cost for deliverable is below those areas around Wyoming.
And when we talk about those costs, so example, and obviously that's spread across, but as an example, if there's you let a contract for $15 million to build something, that we would attribute 8.23% of that is our share of administrative costs on that project.
That's correct, and that becomes a billable event to FHWA, the Federal Highway Administration. And they return that to us. And that covers my cost. I'm considered an administrative employee, so that would cover the cost of my position at 8.23% and all the other administrative costs that we have in that pool.
So that doesn't count. That takes the patrol side. That's not included in that, right? We're just talking about the highway construction and maintenance?
Actually, we consider administrative costs, it's the global pool.
Global pool.
You take the global pool to develop the percentage, and then that percentage becomes a billable event across the global pool.
So how do you allocate the director? How much of him goes to this side, and how much of him goes to patrol or whatever else he does? Because I know he's a man of many talents and hats.
I'm really trying to avoid what I want to say.
Yeah, Director, will you excuse us for a few minutes? Go take a smoke or something. Though.
I was asked a question one time when I was working on the RRS Steering Committee. We were spending long hours, and I was doing a process for the STAR report, and they made a comment and said, Kevin, you're awful expensive to be doing that work. And I said, well, I might be expensive by the month, but I'm really cheap by the hour.
Yeah.
We had talked about PE and CE this morning as well. PE is preliminary engineering, and CE is construction engineering or administration of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
We have a cost to develop a plan to let that work, specifications and deliverable of the expectations of the contract. That's preliminary engineering. And then we have construction engineering, which would be the administration to see that, in fact, they do deliver what we've asked for. On a seven-state average, that cost...
And you're talking about the CE cost now?
CE and PE combined.
Okay, and then the numbers you gave us already, that was just PE?
That was administration cost.
Administration only. Okay.
Yeah.
So the PE, CE was construction engineering. PE was professional.
Professional engineering.
Which is the design. The construction engineering is the contract.
Administration.
The contract administration and their contract officers, essentially.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So if you look at the seven state averages, Wyoming and their average around Wyoming, which is a real good measure. That average is 17.58%. Wyoming's average, now this is from 2006 through 2012, these averages. Wyoming's average to that seven-state average for the same period of time is 16.38%. Now, that seems like a small number, but when you're applying it to the budget for capital outlay for projects and YDOT, that's a significant amount of money. That relates to about $3.6 million a year.
Yeah, $100 million there and $100 million there, and pretty soon you're talking about a lot of real money. The
the national average is 20.14%. That would be a really significant savings. But Wyoming does have a lower percentage than the surrounding states for our PE and our CE.
And do we do, how much of the CE, almost all of that's in-house, how much of the PE is in-house?
Mr. Chairman, it varies from year to year. We're not using as much outside help right now. When we staff for our design functions, and our contract administration, we've got a certain staff level, and as our peak load goes up and we use consultants, as that goes down, we use less. The number of contracts have gone down because of inflation, so we're using less consultants. But typically, it's ranged anywhere from about 40% consultants work on the high end. I think we're probably in the neighborhood of about 10 maybe now.
10% now, so you got 90% of the PEs being done in-house?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. And I assume that's reflective on the economy and how much money you have to spend on road construction or the project.
Yes, Chairman, that's correct. For example, if we were to get the gas tax, and that's roughly $47-50 million a year, that was to come in, our in-house services are full, so I would guess the lion's share of that is going to be under consultant contract.
And with respect, I mean, most of these guys are civil engineers, I'd assume, right?
Yes.
So are you pigeonholed in a PE side or a CE side, or are there guys that can do either or both?
Mr. Chairman, can do either or both. It's really their choosing. They can work in the field and work and go transfer into headquarters, do both. I actually started in design, spent a couple of years in design, and then the rest of my time was out in the field.
Okay. All right.
Senator Perkins,
yes.
The percentage that we discussed earlier, in fact, includes our in-house PE and consultant PE.
Right.
So it's total PE and CE costs.
All right. The out of our seven state, what was the low, do you know? Or you just know the average?
I think it was us.
Oh, we brought down the average. Is that what you're telling us? Okay, quick, let's be done. We're done. Hi, Mr. Chairman. How are you today? Well, sit down. We got room. We're having fun, but all the fun will be over by the time you get in here. Excuse me, Mr. Hibbert. Go ahead. I was just wondering if we knew what the high and low was on those ratios. You gave us the seven state averages at 17.58, I think, and
Colorado is at 24.18, and I probably should have said the state south of the border.
Never mind. I won't. I was going to ask if since marijuana is now a recreational drug and marijuana, does that have any effect on their? Never mind. But we'll just move on. So, hey, did you have another state there you wanted to? When we were the low, that Colorado's the high end, was Wyoming the low?
Yes, the state with the big rock faces would have 7.64%. But the analysts of that broke apart. Because they were at 16.35%, which is just right in our ballpark, but their reporting model changed, so I wouldn't say that that particular state is an accurate representation. But, however, I did include it in the average anyway. Okay. But we did call that state repeatedly and try to get an answer for why that massive change in those percentages, and when we started to ask more detailed questions, we got more scientific.
I just can't imagine. That's just got to be a statistical outlier, I would assume.
So basically, the state that's directly the way west of us is 15.67%. The one that's north is 21.16%, and then there's another outlier to the one that has big red uniforms. We weren't able to identify why they were an outlier either.
You mean they're in prison? What's a big red uniform? That one misses me. Big red uniform.
Let's say they have a high propensity of corn shucking.
Oh, okay, thanks. That's right. They're in a different league, so I just don't even, we don't pay much attention to the Big Ten anymore.
But when we reviewed those PE costs, there's those two states that we just really couldn't understand why that their reports that way, but we did include them in the averages anyway. But the real ones that are really good comparables would be south of the border, 24.18%, our potato state, which would be 21.22%, and the state directly west of us, which is 15.67%.
Thank you. And one other thing about that on the on the PECE costs. How much of the PECE costs is driven by federal requirements? Your friend from the Federal Highway Administration, and how much of that is just it's just because it's good, it's best engineer, it's just best engineering practice. I mean, let me rephrase that. What I want to know is, you guys, I understand we build roads to last. We want them to have a 20-year or whatever, I think 20-year or whatever that life expectancy is for those things. We want them to have that. So we want to design great roads. But I'm just wondering how much of our engineering costs has increased due to federal requirements that would probably be above and beyond what you would do if you had your druthers.
Mr. Chairman, Dale McComey, Chief Engineer. We've never run any studies on that. I think it'd be kind of difficult to do, but I know Utah a couple of years ago said in their review, and they've been pretty loud on this, at the ASHTO meetings, which is the 50-state meetings talking about this, they estimate that it costs them 20 to 25% more to do a federal aid job just because of the paperwork and everything else involved than they do on their state projects. And the interesting thing that Utah has done because of that, Utah is roughly 85-15 in their funding. 85% of their funding for their DOT comes from the state, 15% from the Federal Highway Administration. I think right now we're at about that. We're at about 85-15 also. But we're 85% federal funded, 15% state funded. And their 15% is larger than our 85. So what they've done is they've taken, and they're doing all their big complicated projects, such as their interstates and some of those with state funds, and they're using their federal funds on less complicated projects so that they can minimize the federal red tape on those projects. And that runs anything from historical, ecological type things, NEPA process, pollution discharge, what they call NPDES, National Pollution Discharge Elimination Systems. How do you keep the soil from the dirt from running off into the streams, and monitoring that, and all the federal things that you have to report on. And so there is a cost to using that state or that federal dollar. I can give you a really good example of that right in our backyard. A few years ago, when we built the passing lanes between Rock Springs and Pinedale, we used 100% state money for that, came through the legislature, and we used state funds. We ran into a couple of situations where we had a gravel pit on private land, wasn't on BLM land, but the BLM was objecting to us using that private gravel pit because it was in, quote-unquote, the viewshed of the Oregon Trail. And had that been a federal job, we would not have been allowed to do that, and we'd have had to do a great deal of mitigation because of that project and those issues being in the viewshed of the Oregon Trail. Because we had state money, that did not apply. Now, we worked with our state SHPO office, and we went out to analyze it and see what impacts, and there weren't. But the BLM office in Pinedale, Wyoming, did not agree with the state SHPO office, and we would have had to do more mitigation had that been a federal job. But since it wasn't a federal job, they didn't have some controlling interest in that NEPA process.
Interesting. Okay. Did you have anything else? Is there anything else this morning that you were supposed to report on to us that we can relay to our
Mr. Cohort? Chairman, we covered our supplemental budget, I think, as thoroughly as we came in the room to do, barring any callbacks or further questions. There is one other handout document that we brought back with us. There were some questions this morning about efficiencies internally. And
that's what this one is.
This handout under a letterhead is one that was given to the governor's office. We have each state agency is required, as part of Governor Mead's commitment that is required of directors, each state agency director has to report on a periodic basis what efficiency moves are being taken. And so what we did is we just copied that same report to you, more compact listing. You'll find most of those in the budget overview document as well, split out into the relative programs.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We appreciate your time and effort. Thanks for coming back. And I'm sorry you were so you know, I'm sorry we didn't have a fuller house to listen to you today. Hey, Tom?
Thank you. Thank you. We had a couple bills where we... Okay. So, if you want to introduce yourself and anyone else you'd like and take us through your...
There we go. My name is Mary Ellen Young. I'm the Executive Director for the Wyoming Miners Hospital Board. I was a board member since the inception, except for 1 year, and I'm a retired miner. I have with me today Don Stauffenberg. He is a retired state mine inspector and a board member. Thank you. What specific questions did you have for me on the budget? We, by statute, we can appropriate 5% of the monies in the state miners hospital fund, a combination of the corpus and the income account annually for the distribution through the Wyoming Miners Hospital Fund. We have done that historically, but historically, I guess, and I've only been in this position about a year and a half, and Mr. Leek, who was in here 8 years, passed away of a heart attack, so it wasn't like I got a lot of training before I came in here. He had always under-budgeted, and then we went back to for B-11s if we needed more money. The question was put to me this year is because the statute says that these funds are appropriated. It was felt that we should put this in a standard budget rather than a smaller budget and then rely on B-11s. So that's why we have the supplemental budget request. We did not spend the 5%. We're projecting a large portion of it. We've moved some money around. Our growth has been substantial. In 2008, we used to offer $1,000 per miner for the miners' medical assistance. We upped it. We weren't getting any takers, basically, for about 3 years. We upped it to $5,000 in 2008, and in 2009, we started having to do B-11s because we had so many people come on board. So that's the history in a nutshell.
But Don, is there anything you need to share with us? We've got to go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I did circulate Wyoming Statute 36-102. It's not numbered, but it should be in the top of your inbox.
Okay. Yeah.
Under paragraph A, this is the language that is, in dispute historically. When Ms. Young testifies that we appropriated, she literally means the Miners Hospital Board is appropriating the funds, not the legislature appropriating the funds. And so based upon a LSO analysis of this, both legal services and fiscal services, it's our belief that those funds should be appropriated by the legislature and not the Miners Hospital Board. That is the purpose of this supplemental request. These are not general funds,
right,
but they wouldn't be moved in there with merely the action of the board and the approval of the governor.
Okay. Any questions, or Representative Stubbs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned this 5% figure of spending. So is this what we're seeing in the supplemental? Is this the 5% for 2014? Then?
The 5% was based on when we did the budget, which was, I believe it was July, the monies that we had available in the fund at that time. And we didn't spend the 5%. I believe it was probably around 8.2 that we could have spent, and the supplemental was 7.3, I think. I'd have to look at it again.
Mr. Chairman, just and understand some of us are rookies, so we're still trying to get our arms around this. But so the $1.5 million that we see there, is that what, as far as your spending authority, how much is that? Is that the full extent of your spending authority, or are you only requesting a portion of your spending authority?
I'm only requesting a portion of the spending authority, but it is probably about 90 to 95% available.
So what is that total spending authority now?
5% of whatever is in the corpus and the income fund and the Miners Hospital for fund.
And what are those balances in? So is that what you're looking
for? As of July 13th, the balance was $86,202,787.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, ma'am. I guess as I'm going through this and I'm seeing the medical expenses and the balance, wouldn't some of these cases be covered under Medicaid, and would some of them be covered under the expansion of Medicaid if that was to happen?
I can't tell you what might happen, but they are. We do make our funds as the last payment source. So when a minor registers, he or she needs to register and give us insurance cards for their primary or their Medicare or their supplemental, and they are all billed prior to us paying anything.
Oh, so you pick up the slack there, then?
Yes.
I see.
Further questions?
Mr. Speaker? I'm sorry. Mr.
Chairman? Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Representative Burkhardt.
Mr. Chairman, just a question on how does what you do tie in with, say, workers' comp payments for permanent disability for hearing loss?
If it's a workers' comp payment, and I would have to familiarize myself better with workers' comp and how it pays, but I know that they would be the primary payer. And we would have to see proof that they have paid their portion, and then we may have some funds to assist. On the hearing, we actually have a hearing aid program where we provide up to $2,000 towards a hearing aid if they go to a preferred provider, or $1,500 if they go outside the preferred provider. When we first started doing this, it was understood that it was a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Well, about 5 years into it, we said, you know, some of these people, their hearing aids are not going to last a lifetime. So we have gone to providing a second hearing aid, but it is based on individual need. The hearing aid provider needs to write me a letter of medical necessity, give me copies of audiograms. I run it past my third-party administrator, claims processor, EBMS, and Billings, and if it looks like a justified statement. And normally it's like there's no adjustment left in the hearing aid. They need some new hearing aids. And they're normally 5 to 8 years old. Then I'll okay a second hearing aid. So we have limited funds. It's not just an open door what they'd be available to receive anyway.
All right. Mr. Chairman, another question. On other types of injuries, say cardiac problems due to mining that will go on forever, what are you paying out of that? Are you paying a disability, or are you just paying for medical treatment?
We pay for medical treatment, and like I say, we're always the last payer. We help with medical treatment and prescriptions, but we have a cap. The most we'll pay to any minor is $5,000 a year. And if they blow that in 3 months, then that's it.
So, for example, I've worked at a number of the mines in Wyoming. If I claim a heart condition due to my work at the mines, is there any qualifications or just my doctor's statement?
It would just be your doctor's statement, but first we'd have to get you registered at a minor. We'd have to verify your employment history, get your insurance information, prove that you're a Wyoming resident, and then you would be available for assistance from us.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of things that I'm trying to, and this may have been discussed before I got here. I know that just, and if you've covered the history of this, my apologies for the redundancy, but, you know, that the act of admission showed, selected four unmet needs for minors in the state of Wyoming that, you know, that they saw for the musculoskeletal, the hearing, the cardiac, and the
respiratory.
And they had found that that set up the lands, you know, for that. And over the years, the Miners Hospital had been considered in Rock Springs. There was a lot of issues because of that. Years ago, the legislature decided to set up a Miners Hospital board, and it, you know, it really just I think improve the services for the miners, because miners in all parts of the state were getting access to, if I'm stating this correctly, the Miners Hospital will, if you're qualified and your injury or your issue is eligible, and they will pay for it, you can go to basically, as she said, that any doctor or any preferred provider in the state. It used to be eons ago that everyone would have to travel to Rock Springs. Well, that's not the case today. People in Campbell County can receive services under the Miners Hospital as a payer of last provider for issues on those four categories. You don't have to say that, as Senator or Representative Burkhart, wouldn't have to say that your heart condition would be related to the mine. It was just simply that you've worked in the mine, you show the eligibility, they proved, and then that condition would be considered, if you had out-of-pocket expenses, then that would be taken care of, as is the workers' comp. If you have, I have hearing loss over a long period of time, and you can't relate it to one incident for workers' comp, but working as a mechanic for the number of years and being around diesel equipment, I've just over the years lost my hearing. Well, the Miners Hospital has paid for hearing aids for me, which I don't have on at the moment because the batteries went dead and I didn't have new batteries. But anyway, but if you have an incident where you had one, if you were next to an explosion in the mine that caused your hearing loss, that's a comparable injury where workers' comp had paid for the doctors and the hearing aids, and usually in something like that there wouldn't be any out of pocket expenses for that. But and I guess that was just a little narrative, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Further questions,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, they have that $5,000, and they have these four needs, so they could spend that $5,000 on just, say, chiropractic benefits if they wanted to?
At one point, yes, but we changed that. And actually, I started, I don't know if you guys are interested in this or not, I was just doing it for history of the different programs and how they've evolved, and the changes that we've made since 2009 to try to rein in spending, making sure that our eligible miners get access to that money, but it's not going to people who maybe weren't totally honest on their eligibility, or maybe they got registered by accident, which we have taken the Gillette office and the Green River office has taken over registration since July. But at one time, we had an overusage of a chiropractor in a certain city in Wyoming that they're expensive. And this was just one little chiropractor's office. They were billing us two times more than any major hospital, any other entity in the state. So I think it was in 2009. I have it in here. We went back and we said, okay, we're going to change. And we had a rule change and said that we're going to cap chiropractic expenses. The payout is the maximum we will pay is $50 per visit, 21 visits per year. So it allows the miners to get chiropractic care, but it also gives us some control on it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess then they could basically go to a chiropractor once every 2 weeks, and $50 is the most you'll pay per visit, so that sounds reasonable. I don't know. It's just that I've learned a lot about subluxation and the benefits of chiropractic care in the past year and a half. I know that at the beginning that there's a possibility that you may have to go as many as three times a week, you know, before they get you into a type of a routine, like going every 2 weeks. But I understand your constraints. And the last question I had was, do you still have that van that goes around the state too?
We did. We actually voted in November, the board did, to suspend the wellness testing for 2013. Our expenses were extremely high, and if you look at the minors participating in that, probably 90% of them were employed with benefits that paid for an annual physical. So we said that's a duplication of benefits. We're going to take this year, we're going to look at what we need to offer, what we can afford to offer, and how to target those individuals that need those services. We did run the wellness van in Cheyenne, because you did express a concern last year. And I advertised in Cheyenne, Wheatland, and Laramie, and I think I only had 11 people show up. But minors, I have to say, minors are very hard to... They're so spread out throughout the state, it's very hard to network with them. So we have spent a huge amount of money in advertising, trying to get word out. I think we're going to be sending individual letters when we do plan benefit changes. That seems to be the most cost-effective.
And I only had one last question, Mr. Chairman, that it was brought up from a gentleman in the Gillette area that they drove the trains through the mines. And I said, it's not really that broad. I see you work for the railroad, and just because you drive your train through the mine doesn't mean that you're a miner or that you participated in working in a mine. And I said, I would ask you how broad a definition is a miner, or working in a mine or around a mine, just because you drive a train through a mine to get a train loaded.
I have to say, Representative Escobel, that is a bone of contention we have. The statute is very broad. We did change the rules in 2009 that said that you had to work 12 consecutive months on a mine site and in order to be eligible. We didn't put the number of hours in there. So some of it that delivers bolts, technically, if they make a delivery once a month for 12 consecutive months, technically they'd be eligible for our benefits. Something that we're addressing.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I was wrong.
Okay, well, we'll note that, Representative Escobel. Any other questions? Any other questions? Hi, Don. How are you? Okay. Thank you very much. Anything else that you would...
I just wanted to add that in October of last year, we did change to more closely adhere to the wording in the statute. On the 36102B1, on the last part of that sentence down there, it says, these four health conditions, it mentions them, and it says, due to labor in the mining industry. So we have instructed our claims processor that we, most emergency room visits, walk-in clinic visits and whatnot, we are not paying on, even if it's a broken leg, because we've come to find out we're paying for snowmobile accidents, four-wheeler accidents, things that are obviously not related to mining. Deviated septums. We're really, you know, as a miner, you know that you're going to have normal wear and tear on your body. There's things that are going to happen. You're going to need rotator cuff surgery. And maybe it's 5 years after you've retired. You can't specifically say a time and date, or else you could tie it to workers' comp. We will help you with those. But when it's very clearly not work-related, we're not going to pay those.
Okay, nothing else? Anything else, committee? Who in the Senate is supposed to carry this? Is it, anything else, Senator Hastert? You're covered? Okay. Thank you very much. Don, what's next?
Mr. Chairman, retirement is up next, and I can bring them in the room.
Yeah, well, let's get him in here, but I really want Co-Chairman Harshman. I'm not sure where he went, but we'll just kind of stand at ease till... Let's stand at ease till... Sound of the gavel.
What'd you do with the fuel tech?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We're on, we have a callback, of course, with Retirement Agency 72 and Director Williams. We had a big request for another look at this by your actuary. So would you like to present that to us?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman Bebo, members of the committee. I'm Tom Williams, Director of the Wyoming Retirement System, and in fact, we're delighted to be here to present the projections that were asked at our last meeting. And I think that we have responded, hopefully, to your request. We're fairly confident that we have, as well as provided some information that we think you might have subsequently needed in order to more fully consider the decisions before you. Also joining me this afternoon is Steve Summers, the chair of our board. We have Ben Brandes, the systems general counsel. Polly Scott, whom you've met previously, who manages our deferred compensation program and communications. We have Amy Anama, who is our communications officer. And most importantly, we have Leslie Thompson from GRS, our actuarial firm. And I'd like to start just by expressing publicly our gratitude to GRS. I don't want you to think that we don't pay them for these services, but to have them turn around the depth of projections that we've asked of them and provided to you and the time frame that has been required, and an appropriate one, is no mean feat, I might suggest. With that being said, I want to, again, as we talk about this contribution potential, to reference you to the second paragraph of our cover letter. You'll find a whole series of documents. I think it's in your packet, numbered 201. But we have a summary document to be followed by the details for each of the plans that were looked at and each of the options. And how we'd like to proceed is to walk you through, or with you, through the summary document, answer any questions that you might have. But primary is, again, our appreciation for your willingness to consider a contribution increase to the system. But importantly, we want to, again, convey the flexibility that the board and staff has in regards to the timing and level of these particular contribution increases. So we've provided some illustrative impacts of various immediate contribution increases along with delays. We looked at the 2 and 2 that has been talked about as of September of 2013 and 14. We've delayed those 1 year each and even 2 years each. But we went beyond that, and you'll see that there was a proposal by Senator Meyer that we also look at maybe bringing in 1 year increases, 1% each year for the next 4 years. We also introduced the delay into that scenario of 1 and 2 years. So the first page of the summary is summary of projections regarding the contribution increases. The first chart there is one that you're familiar with. And we only reference you to it because it, again, reminds us of the programs or the plans for which we're focusing our attention this time out. And those would be the state plan, the big plan, as we call it, Wardens and Patrol, and Fire B. Now, if you were to go to page 2, the first scenario affects what we discussed with you last Friday, and that was the impact on our system, the big system, if we were to do 2% on both September 1 of 13 and 14 for a total increase of 4%. Those would have taken the funded ratio of the program, assuming all of those assumptions are met, and we've revised our assumptions. Those have been adopted, as well as assumptions relative to investment earnings. That is now 7.75, as you all know. That would have gotten us to the 101. The alternatives to that were to delay, if I could say that properly, delay the 2 and 2 from 2013 and 14 to 14 and 15. And so the second column there shows the impact of that. The delay would reduce the funding level just modestly to about 98.7% in the 30 years in 2042. And the cost or the impact on the contribution level of such a delay would change the contribution required from 2% to 2.1%. So the total of 4 would increase to 4.2 if the goal is to get to 100% in 30 years. And with that higher recalibrated contribution, you see we'd get to 100.7%.
Senator Perkins.
And so as we look at the recalibrated, that's from our discussion about what if we do that, then what's the real number would have to be in order to get to approximately 100% at the end of the amortization period.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct.
Okay.
And continuing on, the next illustration shows if we were to delay for 2 years, the implementation of that 2 and 2 contribution scenario. There, too, we see the delay would lower the contribution level to 96.4, a very strong funded ratio, quite frankly, but it's below the 100% that's been targeted on behalf of the legislature and our board. And the recalibrated rate from the 2% with the 2-year delay would be 2.25, resulting in a total contribution of 4.5% and a return to 101% funded ratio over that 30-year time frame. And so I don't know if there are questions as it relates to these initial scenarios, because those are the ones that respond to the initial request of this committee. Continuing on, we have the scenario that Senator Meyer had proposed, and that's the effect of the 1% each year for the next 4 years beginning this fall. And to do so would be a total contribution of 4% in terms of increase and get us close to 100. It would get us to 98.7%. And again, as the Senator has observed, to the extent we wanted to get that plan to 100% within the 30-year amortization period, the contribution would increase to 1.1% during each of those 4 years. The continuing illustration, so if we were to delay the commencement of those 1-1-1-1 contribution increases from 2013 to 2014 and from 2013 to 2015. And then looking at the 2014 column, the one that's second from the bottom, it would reduce the funded ratio by the delay of 96.5% funded ratio. 1.1 again gets us back to 100. And under the one that follows, the funded ratio reduces with a 2-year delay to 94.3. Still very, very strong funded ratios, but less than the 100 that's been mandated. And the recalibrated rate is the 1.2% per year for a total contribution rate of 4.8%. So if we would, I'd like to turn to page 3. And we've actually provided budgetary estimates of the impact of these particular changes. And if you'll look at the column that's below, what that exhibit illustrates is that, and we did this over a 5-year time frame, is that the additional cost to the 5-year budget on a calendar year basis, because our retirement system operates on a calendar year basis, for the proposed 2 and 2% scenario commencing in this September is $306.1 million, and that's $3,853.9 million over 30 years. The 1-year delay saves $13.2 million in 2013, and 14, and $64.5 million over the 5-year period, but over the 30-year period cost an additional $112.9 million. Likewise, the 2-year delay saves $135.8 million over the first 5 years, but costs $307.6 million over the 30-year period. But and we've also provided a similar illustration if we go to page 4, for Fire Plan B, and we've also done this for the Warden and Patrol Program. Now, what's interesting on the paid Fire B program is that with the contributions beginning in September of 2013 of 0.9 and 0.9 in 2014 for a total increase of 1.8, they do get to 103%. But the delay, in fact, has very little impact on that program. So if we were to delay 1 year, as in the second column, it reduces their funded level to 100.7%, and a delay in for 2 years reduces it to about 100.1%. So we've not recalibrated any increased contribution rates for the paid Fire B plan because there are no additional contributions required to sustain them at the 100% level. And so what that illustrates in some respects is that certainly as with the other programs, this perhaps even more so, there's no urgency to do anything immediately with this particular program. And in terms of the cost of paid Fire B, if you were to turn to page 5, it shows you for each of the 5 years the cost, baseline cost on the current contribution rate. To its right, the proposed 1.8% increase, the cost of that on a year-by-year basis, and the impact of the 1 year delay and the 2 year delay, as well as the 30-year cost. And so that you can see under the 1 year delay, the cost is 27.9%, $27.9 million, pardon me, versus the 28.4 it would have cost if we were to put it in immediately. 2 years is 27.4 savings because you're not putting the money in immediately. But then the 30-year cost, as you can see, the cost over the 30-year period is illustrated below. And so we didn't do any recalibrations for it, as I said, because the plan would always remain above 100%. And finally, the warden's plan, we have illustrated there their proposed contribution increases as well. You can see under the proposed scenario initially beginning in the fall, the funded ratio will be 101.4. But the delays in 1 year would reduce the implementation of their 3.6%. Total 7.2% contribution to 99.3%. If that were to, again, be delayed 1 year to 2014, the recalibrated contribution would be 3.75% to achieve the 100% funded ratio. Again, that's the target of all of these programs. And finally, the last column on that page shows the impact of the 2 year delay. Without a contribution increase, 97.3% funded ratio with recalibrated contributions to 4, they get to 101.4. And finally, on page 7, the actual cost of the plan changes and the delays in the context of warden's plan. So this exhibit illustrates that the additional cost of the 5-year budget, again on a calendar year basis, for the proposed 7.2% scenario commencing 3.6 in 2013, that's $8.1 million, and $115.3 million over 30 years. The 1 year delay saves $1.3 million in 2013 and 14, and $1.7 million over the 5 year period, but over the 30 year period would cost an additional $2.7 million. And each of the documents that follow really breaks down each of these programs. They start with the public employees plan, looking at the 1 year delay, the 2 year delay, and subsequently the 1-1-1-1 contribution scenario and delays in it of 1 year and 2 years. And then finally, we look in detail at the paid Fire B and the warden and patrol. And I'd be delighted with the assistance of my colleague here from GRS to answer any questions you might have.
I think everybody's still working it there, getting ready.
So.
Any questions? Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Williams. So in looking at it, you know, there's a pretty good case in maybe in holding off for the big plan and even fireman, fire B. But, I mean, do we have the luxury on the warden's plan of waiting to the same extent? I mean, should we look at these all with one eye towards all three plans, or is it worth evaluating separately on whether we need to move forward with a contribution or not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, let me say that we look at each of these plans independently, but I think it's safe to say that we don't see any extraordinary pressure to move on any of these programs at this particular juncture. Because, as you know, and we've stated a number of times, the funded ratio can be affected fairly dramatically on a year-to-year basis by changes in the earnings assumptions or the actual earnings results. So we try to not to make decisions on shorter-term time horizons and look over the longer-term period. And as I think, as Steve Summers had stated when we last met, that these are the best numbers that we have, and we rely on them greatly, but they are formed based on an aggregation of assumptions, which will, we know, vary from year to year. So we think that over the longer term, over the 30-year time horizon, they do move toward that median and are reasonably reliable for purposes of forecasting here. But a delay of a year or two, you know, is not meaningful in the context of what could happen between now and then. The plan's position could improve or deteriorate, quite frankly, but we don't want to make a decision based on really short-term dynamic results.
Anyone else? Senator Meyer.
Yeah, Tom, I think that what you just said is important to take into consideration, but I want to look at, you know, some generalities that we might be able to say that if we put in the new assumptions that, let's start with currently, we're basically trending flat to slightly improved in our funding ratio, and with the new assumptions we're trending slightly down to moderately down. Would that be the trend line assumptions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that is an accurate characterization. I think on the front page of that summary memo, it shows for the big plan, and particularly for each of the plans that we're talking about, a modest uptick if we were using existing assumptions and a negative impact of the adoption of the new, and we think, quite reasonable assumptions.
And Tom, I think could you maybe go into how important trend line is versus a snapshot in time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I'd be delighted to, and I will also invite my colleague here to aid my characterization. But if we look at activity, results, investments, demographics, or others on a short snapshot, it is likely that we will miss what I'll characterize as the bigger picture. And so for pension funding purposes, what we tend to do is look at segments. We tend to look at, from investment perspective, market cycles of 5 to 7 years to determine what we think is an appropriate investment return assumption. It may or may not be changed upon that review. And in the context of the demographic factors, we want to look at those factors over blocks of time, 5 to 8 years. But trending is significant in the context of what you do in a pension plan, how you want to respond. Because if you have a plan that's, let's just say it's deemed to be reasonably healthy, but we are not making the level of contribution that is required by the plan, the so-called annual required contribution, and the funding ratio is trending down, and we know that we're going to go below 80% into the 70s and perhaps in the 50s, then you would be more inclined to make a contribution recommendation, a contribution increase recommendation, than if, on the other hand, you were at merely 80%, but you knew the contributions that were being made were adequate to trend you over time, assuming those other assumptions were met, to your target. And so the trend line that we see for the current program, absent contribution increase, is declining. But this contribution increase could occur essentially at any point during this trend line or trend term measurement that we're talking about.
This one might be a little bit harder question, Mr. Chairman. Tom, what would be the normal variability in the deviation between funding ratios over a reasonable time period? Assuming that you have a flat contribution rate, your market forces are implied there, assuming all other characteristics of demographics and all other actuarial assumptions are essentially stable, over a course of 5 or 7 or 10 years, whatever is reasonable, that you could give us an idea about the variability in the funding ratio.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, one of the things I would look at, for example, to answer your question, if I look at the big plan under current assumptions, that's where we're assuming the 14.12, there's no changes and there's no gains or losses. There you only see over a 30-year period an increase of 7-8%. And that's really slow. And that's so my point is, I can't answer your question right with any rule of thumb, which I know you guys like those, but because every plan's different. It's slow on this plan because the annual required contribution isn't getting made. So there's a drag on the system because of that. The other part of the answer is, if you're currently at 60%, or if you're currently at 80%, for example, and your funding goal is 100% in 30 years, what is that? 1-1.5% a year. That's more of your sight line, what you're aiming for to improve the funding of the plan to the 100%.
Okay. I guess from what I've seen is that that 1 year you might come in and everything's the same, but the market in your 5-year rolling average might, from 1 year to the next year, it may deviate 5 or 6%, and as you roll off high years or low years, every year you could have a range of about 5%. And in fact, I think we've seen it in 1 month you could maybe deviate that much. So these are numbers that I think that type of discussion may be to give the committee an idea about that it is a science, actuarial science, so to speak, but there's enough variation in it that it's hard to hit the bullseye.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, there is no bullseye.
Yes.
To hit, but I would echo what Mr. Williams said. That is. And I think this is what you're saying, Senator. We don't want to make long-term decisions on short-term fluctuations. And the system employs a lot of risk management tools in terms of smoothing assets and the funding methods and stuff to make everything as smooth as possible so we all can make as smooth the decisions as possible, because these are long-term decisions. I don't know if that answered your question.
I think it did, and I think gave the committee an idea about how to characterize the assumptions that we have on our pages here, that we have about a 5% swing from the, or 6% swing, irregardless of which assumption from one end to the other, but over the course of 30 years, that could be a lot wider deviation with unknown variables that we face.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think I would agree with your statement, and I think that we find ourselves in an investment environment which represents and reflects a level of market volatility that's greater than we've seen historically. And so the kind of shifts year to year are and can be substantial one way or the other. And that just further supports the decision-making process employing a longer-term time frame, quite frankly. We think the 30-year horizon is that for amortization of our liabilities and for making our assumptions, but we also are prepared to modify those in a reasonable time frame, but not, you know, year to year, quite frankly. The demographic aspects of these things, of these assumptions are reasonable and definable because they're looking at actual results, but the market components of this can't be predicted, at least short term, with any reasonable degree of reliability. We, in our investment program, do try to take steps through the diversification of our asset base to lower the volatility, quite frankly, but we're not immune from that because we participate in the global markets.
Mr. Chairman, I guess another question is that although the legislature has put a bullseye, which can't be we defined at 100%, as far as policy and rate contributions, and I think we discussed is that trend line is more important necessarily than an arbitrary bullseye in determining your policy decision to increase contribution rates.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we would agree totally. The trend line is imperative. I heard it once characterized that if I take your temperature and it's 80 degrees, it matters a lot if it's going up or going down. And it's the same thing for pension funds. I also wanted to mention that you had used the word arbitrary and the 100%. I think what you're getting at is some plans are talking 90, 80, these other percents.
Yeah.
The 100% is set as a goal for most plans because that's the point at which the contract, say, between the taxpayer, you, and the system provides the greatest honoring in terms of using the money most efficiently.
Fully met, and I agree with you.
Right. So Social Security, that's 0% funded, the dollar in every check is coming from taxpayer revenue. It doesn't come from investment earnings. But in a well-funded, actuarially funded plan, meaning getting to 100% funded, only 20 cents out of every dollar is coming from taxpayer money and the rest from investment earnings. And that's why you have a defined benefit plan that's pre-funded, and that's why the target is best set at 100%. If you set it at 90 or 80, you lose that 80-20. It gets more and more expensive to the taxpayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, anyone else? Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Good. You explained to me the proposed assumptions is based on what rate of return?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moniz, it's 7.75% annually.
I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, sir.
Was it any follow-up there? Senator Perkins?
And I understand what you're saying. I guess, and I know that originally when we talked about looking at the funded ratios by plan, and we look at those, that you use the 12% investment rate as illustrative of what the effect of 1 year can have on the plan as a whole. But yet, as I look at the sheets and as we look at the trend line, we've taken. It seems to me that as we look at the trend line and the graphs associated with the trend line, like my good friend Senator Meyer's been talking about, that in some respects we're looking at that and we're saying slow down or you don't have to make a decision, but we've also now used an assumption with 12% this year instead of rounding 12% into the 7.75 that we're thinking about going forward. So I'm struggling with the fact that the recommendation, as I'm understanding it today, is that, hey, let's just see what happens for another year or two before we make any decisions on whether or not we should increase contributions. When even with the 12% funding, we've got what appears to me to be at least a significant downward trend line. And so I'm puzzled why you are resisting any you know, even minor mid-course corrections here at this point in time?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a very good question. And again, I think it goes back to our tendency to look at longer time frames for purposes of making these judgments, these recommendations. And when we came before this committee in late December, one of our proposals, or at least the proposal of our board, was that we were going to await the actual investment results for 2012, mm-hmm. of which we don't have as yet, quite frankly. We think it's going to be about 12%, so we increased the asset growth by the 12% that we think we've made for 2012. But then going forward, we reverted to the 7.75% that the board has embraced for the economic scenario going forward. So I think we do believe there it will be a need for a contribution increase, but we didn't want to convey some sense of magic timing that it has to be this moment versus six months from now.
There's no magic timing, Mr. Chairman. This is all black art, as near as I could tell. It's at best, but anyway, keep going.
No, so, sir, you know, we think that there is flexibility in terms of timing. I believe that this body, the executive branch, you have a number of competing interests, and I don't want to convey some sense that this bears an urgency that may cause you to act in a way that you wouldn't if you knew that there was flexibility. There is flexibility, quite frankly. We think we'll need a contribution increase at some point, but there is great flexibility in the timing of that and the amount of that contribution.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just follow up just a little bit more. And so I understand that, and you know, like most things, timing is everything. And as we look forward, I mean, if you look forward into the 2015-2016 time period, Mr. Chairman, and we're staring down the barrel of another 140. I guess it depends whether you talk to the governor's office or the LSO, whether it's $140 or $156 million in additional cuts. And I think the opportunity that when you look at even delaying into the next biennium, that the appetite and the ability to make contributions at a later date is probably more difficult than having them built into the system right now. And anyway, I mean, as you look forward in that reality, if we're really staring down the barrel, and there'll be pink slips, if we really do cut $140 million out in the next biennium, there'll be a number of pink slips out there, which is going to be reducing the number of slots that are available to pay in. And I'm just wondering, you know, as I look in the crystal ball over the next 3 years and what we as an appropriations committee are faced with, I'm concerned that if we don't take act, at least we don't take some modest action now, that we may find this incredibly exacerbated in another 2 years. What do you think about that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't question your the Senator Perkins' perspective on that, but if we had a crystal ball, it would probably look at a longer period than the next biennium.
Anyone else? Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, I just asked Steve if he had any comments that he would like to make about any of this. As chairman of the board?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think Tom and Leslie expressed where the board is pretty accurately. If you recall, our testimony
in December, our original idea was to come to you next summer after we've got this year's valuation, after we've got these new assumptions factored in. It seemed to us an appropriate time to approach you with a contribution rate increase because it is... You will be dealing with a new budget. I mean, it's a budget session. We would go through the normal budget process next interim, next fall, and then into the budget session. Whereas we would sit down with the governor and talk to him about what we need. We'd come here and talk to you guys about what we need, and then, of course, the whole legislature. But it just seemed to us to be a better approach to work through the normal budget process, which would start next year. So as far as delaying it, it's like I said last time. I mean, you can't argue the math. The sooner you do it, it costs you less. But like I said last time, too, we know the issues that you guys are dealing with respect to your budget, and not just the state budget, but everybody that's an employer in this system, the school districts, county governments, local governments, all their budgets are in question right now, as well as the effect that any kind of a contribution rate would have on employees. So, you know, we're not against delaying it by any means. But we also understand that, you know, the sooner the better, and you can't argue the math. So, you know, that's just something that you guys are going to have to hassle out.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Mr. Co-Chair, I got one for Tom, too. And Steve, if you want to jump in on it, the one that the warden's one, you know, we've kind of looked at the big plan, but it's a lot more problematic than the others. I know it's a small one, but still, those people that are in it, I mean, to them, it's pretty big. Do you have the same position on that one? Delay is probably okay, but we don't know, and on it goes. What's your opinion on that one?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Vibau. You know, we do acknowledge that the required contribution increase for that program is significantly larger than those that are being proposed for the other two plans that are under discussion here. But I think, again, looking at the page 6 of the summary illustration, you'll see the delay in the program or the contributions of either 1 year or 2 years reduces the targeted funded ratio from from the original 101.4 to 99.3, which is, I'd say, a pebble's throw from the 100, and then in 2 years, 97.3. So I would have to agree that with Mr. Summers, in the context of it's a larger issue, larger contributions required, but they're for the same reasons are the illustrated flexibility.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, but the difference, of course, is you're looking at 3.6% 2 years in a row, which is a whole lot more than 1%. And that, of course, is the reason I bring that up is we could have the same scenario there. That's pretty tough in a going into a budget cycle where we're making substantive cuts. So
I agree. And plus, their contribution rate is also pretty high, is it not? Is it 22%?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, yeah, and remember, we just increased it, too. I mean, last year we added 3.25%. And, yeah, their total contribution is like 25, 26%. So we're talking about taking them to 30-some percent. That, to me, and I've had these discussions with Tom, and I don't want to start a whole new, open a whole new can of worms.
So
but at
this
some
before,
point,
Steve, so you said, I guess I always thought the wardens was like in the 22 or something.
I think it's around 25%, Mr. Chairman. This would take them, this would take wardens to pretty close to 30% or above. Mm.
Okay.
And what I was going to say was at some point, we need to have a discussion about whether we need to keep them as a separate plan or not. We've got a law enforcement plan, and we have this plan, and it's like, you know, why? And when you start talking about a 30% contribution rate, majority of which has been picked up by the employers, you know, it's time that we had a bigger discussion on that whole thing.
Okay. Else? Senator Meyer.
And, you know, and I probably should remember this, but I don't, so I'll ask you guys out there. What we made a lot of changes in the benefits of the big plan. I'm wondering about any thing that we've done lately for the wardens and Highway Patrol as far as making changes in benefit structure. I'm trying to recall any discussions that we've had on that on the board, it's not coming to mind right now.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we've made any changes to the other two programs, the warden or law enforcement, for example. We did make changes, as you suggest, in the context of the big plan with the new tier of benefits, new retirement ages, new benefit formula, quite frankly. But I don't at this juncture recall any changes that were made to the benefits of the law enforcement program. In fact, I believe I recall testimony to our board, rather than entertain any change in benefits that may be required as a result of need for additional contributions, they elected to increase their contributions, quite frankly, to maintain the current structure.
Mr. Chairman, I think I recall that up in Casper, where that's exactly what their representatives told us, is that rather than make any cuts in the benefits or any other thing, is that just take it out of our hide and we'll be glad to pay it. And, you know, I think maybe this year the board can bring those guys back in and show them this particular picture and discuss with them and ask them whether that's still their position, if they know that it's going to be almost a 33% contribution. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that's, I guess Tom would phrasing the question, would you agree that that perhaps might be appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, indeed we wholeheartedly agree. We're engaging in discussions with all of our plan representatives on an ongoing basis, and obviously when changes of this magnitude are contemplated relative to contributions, there are some decisions that actually those members, those beneficiaries, have to participate in making.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Tom.
Anyone else? Okay. Appreciate it. We have a bill that we probably need to talk about and decide whether we're going to table it or go forward, and it's the 2+2 bill. I guess I could just kind of take a straw poll of the committee if we want to take time to hear that and decide whether we want to run with that bill. Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, after listening to what we've seen, I think the 2+2 is something I'm probably not interested in doing, but I'm not sure that the one or something like that might not be something we might want to consider. I'll yield, and maybe, you know, we could do and it wouldn't hurt to listen to the bill and real quick, like, because it's pretty easy to see what it does, and then if there's an interest in the committee, we could get it drafted and out there. It's a long ways from becoming law if we do that. I guess it would be a Senate file. I don't know, how do the senators feel about that? Anybody have any strong opinions one way or the other?
I don't think we need to do it, but so that's just mine.
I have opinions. I don't know how strong they are, Mr. Chairman. I think that in listening to them, my gut instinct is to do something, at least do something. It's been educational, and I think that, you know, taking a longer term view and understanding the variances that come into play as you do this, but I don't know that we have to do anything particularly abrupt. But I think what I think we should do seriously is I would think that we should think about a minor adjustment, a minor increase in the contribution rate, at least on a couple of these, but maybe make them effective for the next budget cycle. And the reason I'm thinking that is that way when people start to do their planning in the next budget cycle, they know, and we've had the debate, and they know what they're looking for, so when we go into the next budget cycle, we've got a plan. So if we anticipate making an increase in the next 3 years, I think we ought to give serious consideration to figuring out what that is and floating that now, so that when we're back here in 9 months looking at the budgets, that those numbers are figured in.
Anyone else? Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an interesting idea. And I mean, one of the other wrinkles is if we were to jump into a 2+2 now that we mentioned earlier, we've got the monies that the governor's requesting for salaries, and that all sort of starts working together. And I mean, looking at an approach like this where we're looking at the next biennium, that certainly eliminates one complexity as we're looking towards that $11 million request.
Well, that was I guess I'll just air, and maybe we'll take a little straw poll on this whether we want to proceed with this. But listening today, I guess I'm more inclined to probably wait till the interim, and then we can study it and probably study some of the broader issues too that particularly with the warden's plan. I mean, I just think we got to, and maybe we can kind of wrap this into a little better plan as we move forward instead of piecemealing it together. But so that's my thoughts on it. I just kind of take a straw poll, members. If you just raise your hand if you want to hear that bill and go through that tonight, if it's something you think we want to support and go forward with. So anybody want?
Quick question, if I may.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, if we had a 2x2 bill plan, I mean, we have that bill. It's a placeholder so that we can make that, turn that into kind of whatever we need it to be, don't we? So we don't have to, in other words, the draft request is in. We've met the deadline for today. We have some time to think. We have some time to discuss that and work that, don't we, moving forward? That's a question for Don or for Dave, probably.
Dave?
We have the draft ready to go. A number of plans with different variations. You have to approve that by the 12th day of the session. And it has not just requested, it has to be the.
Senator Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm sensitive of the position the board and the director are in, being right in between us and the governor in this situation. But I also know and I can't argue with the math that we do need to do something. And at the very least, I think we need to put forth a proposal that would allow the governor's office to, in his deliberations for the next budget cycle, to have a certainty that there would be at least a minimum of 1+1, if not a 2+2 plan. So during those deliberations, as the good senator from Casper alluded to, that they could be made part of the process. My own preference is, personally, is to at least have 1% this year, and in part because there is money available all in the budget for payroll, although be it not exactly as the governor had planned, but at least if there's money in the budget to where I think we could structure that to offset any effect that it would have negatively on state and other employees. I'll go back to that being one of the things that we certainly need to consider is to mitigate any negative effects. So if we do this, we're not asking employees in any area to take a pay reduction. So I think we have two different ways we could go about it. We can draft that bill as a request, and then it's at least a placeholder, and we can move forward with what the will of the body is.
Okay. I why don't we just take a little straw poll at whether this is going to be a committee bill or not. If anybody would like to hear this bill, just raise your hand. I'm looking for if there's a quorum on both sides. If not, this is going to be looks like a Senate, maybe appropriations bill. So we got 1, 2, 3, 1. So I think this would be a Senate bill, and just taking that little straw or an individual bill, but we won't take joint committee time tonight to hear the bill. Okay, Mr. Co-Chair, are you okay with that?
Sure,
Mr. Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair. What we'll do, Senate, is we'll get together and let's see. The 12th day would be, what do we got, next Tuesday? If we decide to do it, to kick it out, what day would it be? Well,
I think, Mr. Co-Chair, we can get to it first part of next week, and we'll be well within the time limits. And Senate members of the Appropriations Committee, I think that, you know, things should slow down maybe for us next week, and so we'll talk, and I'll think about it, and we'll do something one way or the other, like we always do. I'm here to okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So we'll just see what we do and go from there.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.